Hey, everybody. It's very, very good to be here again, 2 weeks in a row. Thanks, Andy. Thanks for reminding me that it was actually Father's Day. Finally, there's a day to, celebrate the underrepresented patriarchy. It's a dumb joke, really, but I guess I am turning into a dad. I guess I think in dad jokes. I really love that song, and all I could think of was, hell yeah. Hell yeah. Okay. Yeah, so I wanted to do 2 weeks on mysticism, because then that will sort of cover the topic, and y'all can move on. I just want to read the quotation that I was using last week. I'm using two quotations from Evelyn Underhill, and who is sort of like the queen of mysticism in terms of kind of a collection of philosophies and ideas and thoughts and musings about what the heck are we talking about when it comes to mysticism and why does it matter? And she seems to be pointing to a kind of reality that there's an underground stream flowing beneath culture and beneath religion and beneath spirituality, and that underground stream is fed by the mystics through their experiences and the fact that they report back that the world is not what you think it is. And I'm kind of just saying, let's try to hold hands with these folks and open to the possibility that the world is not what we think it is. That's why we need the mystic. I'm not trying to turn you into one, and I'm not claiming to be one. I'm just saying, how open do you want to be in terms of being open and inclusive? Okay, so here's the quotation I used last week. It's all like kind of dark in here all of a sudden. That's how I like it. In mysticism, that love of truth, which we saw as the beginning of all philosophy, the love of truth, that's the meaning of philosophy, I suppose, leaves the merely intellectual sphere. So we leave the intellectual sphere and takes on the assured aspect of personal passion. Where the philosopher guesses and argues, the mystic lives and looks and speaks. Consequently, the disconcerting language of firsthand experience, which is why I told you that kind of funny thing from Jung in the BBC last week. Do you believe in God? He said, I don't believe I know. That's the disconcerting language of firsthand experience, not the neat dialectic of schools. Hence, whilst the absolute, which she capitalizes, the absolute of the metaphysicians remains a diagram, impersonal and unattainable, the absolute of the mystics is lovable, attainable, and alive. And they sort of report back, saying, truth is not abstract, it's something like a capital T which you can experience. And it's lovable. It's like, oh, okay, thanks for the report. So what might I want to say? I just want to say maybe two things about that quotation, then I want to read the next one. And it's just a reminder from last week. She calls this instinct the instinct for the absolute. And she says it lives in all people. Like we have this instinct for the absolute. Like we're drawn toward the absolute, even if we say we don't know what it is. It pulls on us. It tugs us. And she says it's an instinct. The mystic happens to be someone who experiences the absolute and sort of orients their life then around it. And just as a reminder, something I said last week, this doesn't make everyone a mystic. You don't have to be a mystic. I'm just saying maybe they have something to share. It's kind of like I don't know if you remember, I did a bunch of things from Ken Wilber a few years ago, and he talks a lot about state and stage confusion. Like we might experience an altered state and think we're in a higher stage of consciousness. And I guess I'm bringing that up now because I think people can have little hints, what we might call mystical states, but that doesn't instantly make you a mystic as you're on some higher plane. We just let that go. Say every once in a while we get one taste of the absolute, or we feel connected in some way, or suddenly we know there's a kind of union that's hard to explain. Okay, here's the second quote, and this one's actually in your, whatever you call those white pieces of paper. Okay. Eternity is with us, inviting our contemplation perpetually. But we are too frightened and lazy and suspicious to respond, too arrogant to still our thought and let divine sensation have its way. It needs industry and goodwill if we would make that transition. In other words, a little bit of effort. For the process involves a veritable spring cleaning of the soul, a turning out and rearrangement of our mental furniture. Now pause for a moment. Not you, but other people, you think they probably need some rearrangement of their mental furniture, correct? A wide opening of closed windows that the notes of the wild birds beyond our garden may come to us fully charged with wonder and freshness and drown with their music the noise of the gramophone within. She wrote this in 1913 or something. Now we can just change it to the phone within. Those who do this discover that they have lived in a stuffy world, like a world that's too small. Whilst their inheritance was a world of morning glory, where every titmouse is a celestial messenger and every thrusting bud is charged with the full significance of life. Do you kind of feel the flavor of what she's talking about? She's saying you live in a room too small. And sometimes something mystical, mysterious, numinous, does a little spring cleaning of the soul, and all of a sudden you hear the world as it is, or reality with a capital R. She says in her book, the best word for God is reality. So she's messing with us a bit. And she's saying, sometimes that reality, the world is suddenly full of significance. And the tiniest little birds are messengers, are angels in a way. That's what a celestial messenger is. And so we say, wouldn't we want to have a taste of that from time to time? And the mystics are the ones, I think, who have visited this country and are reporting back. Or they're astronauts. We were coming up with funny metaphors in the pre-talk. They're astronauts, and they venture out onto the edges of consciousness, and they come back with, like, moon rocks and say, see? And, you know, sometimes, you know what you're talking about. But every once in a while, maybe it breaks through or breaks us open. Okay, so let's go a little further with this metaphor, because once you start talking about big words like mysticism, all you can do is use allegory, analogy, metaphor, symbol, hints and guesses, things like that. So, okay, so here's an image. Suppose your consciousness, your mind, your awareness, your worldview, something like that, is a room, okay? And what's your job? In a way, your job is to explore the room. I mean, and actually, the exploration of the room, it like sort of makes the room come into being. Like, okay, there it is. This is my room. And you have some say in how to arrange the furniture. Now, maybe you have some limits. Maybe you didn't build the room. Now, I'm going to go crazy with the metaphor here. In other words, you didn't create yourself, but you find yourself in a room, and you start exploring it. And some of you are good explorers, and some of you are, not you, but other people are kind of lazy. They don't want to look around too much, all right? They don't want to look behind them, for example, all right? But some of you are pretty good at exploring, and you're like, okay, this goes here, and this goes there, and then this picture goes on the wall here, and you get to know it really, really well. And especially if you're on any kind of spiritual path, you really want to explore your room. You want to say, I want to understand my own life. Am I making sense? That's the room of your consciousness, right? And the mystics, every once in a while, they have rooms too. They start to get a little bored with the room, and they start looking out the window. And they're like, what the heck is that? And then one day they just leave altogether. And they leave the window open, all right? And, okay, so that's enough of the metaphor right now, okay? You have a room. It's the room of our consciousness. And I'm saying, though no one asked for permission, somebody left the window open. And every once in a while, the breeze blows in and messes up the papers on your desk. You're like, where is that? I can't find that. Or a big hailstorm comes through. And, you know, a huge wind comes through and knocks over the flowers. And you're like, that's not how it should be, okay? I know this is getting absurd at this point. My point is, the mystics open the window. They leave, but they leave the window open, all right? And the breeze, like Rumi says, the breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. And something wafts in and changes and disrupts our room. And it could be anything at all. And any kind of expansion of human possibility might blow in from the outside world, from the world that's larger than your room. And wouldn't you agree, as a fundamental starting place, the world, reality, is larger than the room that you presently inhabit? Well, obviously. All right, so having a relationship with, quote, the mystics, or being curious, mystically curious, something like that, it's a dumb phrase, I made it up, is like being okay with the window open. And noticing when the breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you and blows in and messes your life up. Like, what does she say in the previous one? They use the disconcerting language of firsthand experience. So I'm saying the wind can be disconcerting at times. The world is not what I thought it was. Okay, as promised last week, you can still ask me, all right, I kind of get what you're saying. Maybe you're right. Maybe you're not. I kind of get where you're going. But still, how would we do such a thing? How would we open ourselves up in some way? Because you know what's a lot easier? To double down on whatever you think your worldview is. That's easy. That's politics. That's ideology. That's Americanism. That's whatever camp you happen to be in. It's just easier to say, I know it. End of story. I don't have to look anywhere else. So how would we open ourselves up? And I have like three suggestions today, and that's really what they are. Suggestion number one. It really comes from, I don't even want to tell you because I feel like I say the name Jung like every time I talk, but he says that there are four capacities of knowing, really. It's a kind of an epistemological claim. And I've used them before here, but thinking, feeling, sensing, and he calls it intuition, but I'm going to change it to imagination or the imaginal, because he also means that. So how do we come to know? How do we come to know anything at all? Thinking, feeling, sensing, and imagination or intuition. And so one way we might open ourselves up to a slightly more mystical way of being in the world is to exercise our imaginal muscle, all right? It's just like if you work out, it's a good idea to work out all your muscles and not just be like, I'm just going to work on my one right bicep until it's huge. Okay, you're like, that would look ridiculous, okay? So thinking, feeling, sensing, and imagination is the most neglected window of knowing in the modern world. In fact, our phones do our imagining for us. Like, they tell us what's important. They give us a series of images. They assault us. And they're very addictive, and they're very alluring. So exercising the imaginal muscle is not scrolling through Instagram, okay? If you want to exercise your imaginal muscle, go hang out with a two-year-old, which is like living around a blender with no top on it. Play, imagine, sing, dance, create, make art, especially if you're bad at it, you know? Especially if you're bad at it. Make one room in your house as beautiful as possible. Go pick wildflowers and give them to someone you hate, okay? That's it. That's the what imaginal possibilities are within your field of possibilities and of awareness. Exercising the muscle of the imaginal. And how is that related to mysticism? Well, if you start reading the mystics, or even a quotation, all they do is speak in imaginal language. Because there's not another way to describe the absolute, or reality, or the numinous, or the mysterious, other than art, and music, and dance, and poetry, and, you know, cave paintings, that kind of thing. So I'm suggesting exercise your imaginal muscle. Or somebody used the phrase in pre-talk, I think this was the phrase, but I wrote it down, practice wonder. Yeah, practice being amazed. And how would you do that? You'd have to open your gaze to the world. And part of opening your gaze is opening to the imaginal, to imagination, to be a kid again in a way, to fall in love with image, symbol, story, myth, dreams, like the old will dream and the young see visions, that kind of thing. One more thing about science, because you might think, oh, he's only talking about poetry. Okay. Science is also, in a way, the discipline of astronaut adventures. They put on their little helmets and they venture out onto the edges of what's known, the edges of consciousness, and they report back. They just happen to use math. Okay? In my opinion, it's virtually the same thing. Though the tools, the technologies are different. The language is different, in my view, at least. And if you think about science, you think, well, it's about facts. They don't use things like poetry, except have you listened to what they call things, like dark matter, or dark energy, or a black hole, where time bends? I mean, how else are you going to describe these things? Do you feel how that's also imaginal? Imagine right now, dark energy, go. Well, you can actually go there. Like, the only way to take one step closer is to begin to expand your imagination. So they're really not worlds apart. I think they're kind of doing the same sort of thing. And I looked up some facts, in case you think, this guy never gives us any facts, just a bunch of poems, all right? Dark matter makes up 27% of the universe. I just think that's funny. You're like, oh yeah, I thought it was 26, but maybe you're right, 27% of the universe. Okay, here's a definition of dark matter. It's a component of the universe whose presence, I can't read my own writing. Is something who knows what I said? It's, first of all, I know I said it's a component of the universe. You're like, okay, yeah, that's right. Dark matter is a component of the universe. Whose presence is something from its gravitational attraction, rather... Inferred. That's not it, but that could be, it's something like that. Inferred from its gravitational attraction rather than its luminosity. Of course, like, that's what I was thinking it was. Oh, here's Jung, just to get back to the godfather here. Life is a luminous pause between two great mysteries. I just think that's interesting. In a definition of dark matter and also birth and death, you have the same word. Okay, here's a definition of dark energy, which, as you know, obviously is 68% of the universe. It's mysterious. It's energy whose mysterious force is responsible for the universe's accelerating expansion. It's an unknown form of energy. Well, wait a minute, how can that be? I thought, no, it's an unknown form of energy spread evenly throughout time and space. For some reason, that makes me laugh. it's a kind of poetry. I'm not saying it's not real, but I'm saying it's a kind of poetry that has to do with expansion of consciousness, that has to do with, in some sense, a mystical disposition. The world is not what I thought it is. Now, I don't know, because one of the things that happens with the mystics is they say we can experience reality with a capital R. We're caught every once in a while in oceanic union with all that is. Now, I don't know if that's possible with dark energy, but I'd say maybe it's the same thing in a way. A taste of reality with a capital R. Okay, enough science, I'm done. Here's point number one was exercise your imaginal muscle. Point number two, tradition matters. And this is a surprise to me. I thought tradition is boring, more or less. That's why I want to deconstruct everything. Let's just tear it all down. Tradition is old and stuffy and annoying and small. And religion is small and annoying. You know, these were, you know, thoughts I had, feelings I had, and in a way that's kind of true. There is some truth to that. It's funny that religion, I said this in pre-talk, claims to be about the absolute, the universal, the transcendent, but then says we need to think about that in the smallest way possible, and only in the way that we're used to thinking about it. And if you veer from that, you're a heretic. So it has this kind of built-in irony. We're talking about the absolute, but we have very narrow confines here. The room is small. And what's interesting, to me at least, is the mystic comes along and cracks the frame all the time, leaves the window open, takes communion, and then blasts through the stained glass window, something like that. And that's important. That's part of the underground stream. The Catholic Church needed St. Francis to walk around with no shoes, wearing like a burlap sack, saying, I was just speaking to Jesus, and he was in that bird over there called the sparrow, you know? And everybody's like, well, that can't be. That's not how we've ordered things. And the mystic comes along and says, I've tasted reality, and suddenly the frame gets bigger. But that's not quite the same thing as saying tradition doesn't matter. I think tradition does matter, and all of you are traditionalists. C3 is the most traditional place. Think about it. Well, I got an idea. Let's gather. Okay, when should we gather? Sundays. Yeah, let's gather on Sundays. Yeah, that's original. That's original. Okay, when on Sundays? Well, I'm thinking Sunday morning. It just kind of came to me all of a sudden. And, well, what should we do on Sunday morning? I don't know. How about some music? Yeah, okay, we can go with music. And then maybe someone will give some talking. Let's have a meditation, too. Why not? And we'll have a liturgy. And we'll have a bulletin. And we'll keep a calendar. Okay, do you see what I mean? Okay, fine. We don't have to be against that. Say it's we're inside of a tradition. And at the same time, this is where tradition and innovation, I think, collide, and that's a beautiful place to be. We do need something fresh. The old need to dream dreams, and the young need to see visions. And we do have to experiment and be progressive and things like that, but only in as much as it clashes with what we know. It's like the edges of your room again. So, okay, why am I going on and on about tradition? Because I think it's important to at least listen to the ancient voices of wisdom, and I would include the saints and mystics and philosophers and artists that have been feeding that underground stream, and not to assume let's just cut ourselves off from the past and now we're free to just walk forward without any threads of connection to the ancient, to the river, so to speak. Which brings me to Rumi. Last week, I committed a sin. I gave a talk without using a poem. I'm sorry. I seek absolution. Is that what it's called, absolution? Yeah, thank you. All right, so do something. I'm asking for... Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, this is Rumi's poem, The Guest House, and you'll see where I got my silly metaphor at the beginning. This being human is a guest house. This being human is a guest house. every morning a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. That's his advice. Welcome and entertain them all. Someone leaves the window open, the wind blows in, a meanness, a depression, a joy. Welcome them. Come on in. Even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Doesn't life do that to you sometimes? I thought things were the way they were always going to be, and some guest comes and sweeps the house clean again. He may be clearing out, he may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. And that little phrase, guide from beyond, that's how a mystic sounds. In other words, they opened the window and they left and they visited the beyond. And they're saying, trust me, trust me. When the breeze at dawn blows through and sweeps your house clean, it may be getting you ready for some new delight. And it's a kind of guide from beyond. And there is such thing as the beyond. That's sort of the message that they're leaving. Okay, this brings me to my third point. Point one, flex your imaginal muscle. Point two, tradition matters. And it's okay to listen to the saints and mystics and let their breezes blow through the house and disturb us a bit. Point three, this is my most unusual point. Maybe I should start with a story. About 20 years ago, a friend of mine said, a pastor, said, maybe we should take a hiatus from using the word God for 20 years. And I was like, this is a great idea. Now, we went and broke it, like, the next week by saying we should not use the word God for 20 years. I actually did give a talk about this. And I kind of got into this idea, like, just stop using the word, all right? But now I'm going to say it's been 20 years. And maybe it's time for the word God again. Maybe it's time for the word God again. Now, you don't have to accept this. But I at least give me a few minutes to kind of wander into that terrain. What do we mean by the word God? Do you know the final thing that I said on my way out of town when I was a pastor? My final sermon, I said this phrase, we don't know what we mean by the word God anymore. That was a conviction I had. We don't know what we mean by the word God anymore. And I still feel that way. But old men ought to be explorers and the young see visions. My feeling is, let's keep going. That's my general feeling. Let's keep going in this kind of exploration of the unknown. So I've got some quotes for you. From Jung. This guy has a problem. All right. To this day, God is the name by which I designate all things which cross my willful path. You know, like when the breeze blows through your house and knocks things down. Let me read it again. To this day, God, he uses quotation marks, is the name by which I designate all things which cross my willful path violently and recklessly. All things which upset my subjective views, plans, and intentions, and change the course of my life for better or worse. And all the people said, amen. Just now, that is a kind of exploration. Like, what do we mean by God? Well, or what do we mean by reality? Something larger. He's saying, whatever my subjective views are, plans and intentions, whatever sweeps in and changes that, he calls that God. That's like leaving the window open. That blows through the house and knocks something. What is this? Who is this? What's going on? That's an interest. I don't believe in God. Okay. Do you believe that every once in a while, things sweep in and change your subjective views? Jung's saying, that's my definition of God. Now, you don't have to agree with them, but I'm just saying, do you feel how that's different? That's a kind of expansion. The room that I call God, you know, he's just like moving the walls out further. Okay? Here's a quote. I got a bunch. I have more than I could possibly share. Here's a quotation from James Finley. He lived in the monastery with Thomas Merton. He says, no idea of God is God. I don't know why that makes me laugh. No idea of God is God. Like, oh, that's a different way of imagining the absolute or the totality or reality or the great nothingness with a capital N. No name, this is me more, but no name for God is God. And actually, that's in Judaism already. You can't even say the name. Like if you talk to an Orthodox Jew, and even when they're reading the Torah, if you've ever been to a synagogue service and they're reading the Torah and they read in Hebrew, when they get to the one of the names for God, there are actually many, but when they get to the primary name for God, they just say the name in Hebrew, Hashem, and they just keep reading. They don't even read the word. They just say the name because no name. Like, how can God have a name? Just like, how can God be a being? Is God a being like you're a being? So no image of God is God, no idea of God is God, no name of God is God, no concept of God is God. These are just the hints that the mystics leave around. Here's one from Barry Taylor. Barry Taylor was the road manager for AC/DC. I met him a few times. We talked about my book once in a coffee shop. He said, God is the word we use for the blanket we try to put over the mystery to understand it. Something like that. Yeah, so Barry Taylor, you know, the great saint. Or, like Jung's definition, God is some kind of mysterious reality that disrupts our subjective views, plans, and intentions. So I'm not sure what to say other than to offer that as a kind of possibility, to keep going, to keep exploring. Maybe we need the word God more than ever instead of less than ever. Like, I don't exactly agree with John Lennon, no offense. Imagine no religion. I get the sentiment, but I don't know what that means, or where do we go from there? What then do we imagine, you know? At least religion says, at its worst, it says, don't use your imagination. At its best, it says, all we have is our imagination, and let's keep going. And maybe that will expand our understanding of the world and our understanding of the interconnectedness of reality and understanding of our neighbors and lead to a greater vision. Okay. One final thing. In the end, the mystical tradition invites us to contemplate these two paradoxical possibilities. And this is the final thing I'm going to say, and it's in some ways the hardest to say. On the one hand, the notion of God is about the totality of absolute being, you could say, or the absolute otherness of reality, which is unknown and is unknowable in its totality. It's utterly transcendent and distant. That's the way sometimes mystics talk about God. God is so other, reality is so other, and distant, and total, and absolute, and fixed in a way that we're we feel like nothing in the presence of it. That's one face of what the mystics contemplate. Here's the other paradoxical side, which is reality is profoundly imminent. That it's not so much God as being, but God as coming into being. That reality itself is the very tip of a kind of emergence, and nothing is fixed. You know that old phrase, God is the same yesterday, today, and forever? The opposite pole is that is impossible. The universe is expanding. Everything is expanding. Everything is coming into being. Someone told me the other day that, I forget exactly, but I think it's like something like every 5 days your cells renew. Like, you're not the same person you were 5 days ago. Thank God. That is like, well, for some of you, really, thankfully. That it's like the tip of evolutionary blossoming is never fixed, which is another way of saying reality is never fixed. God is never fixed. So this is the hard thing to say. The mystics come along and say both things are true at the same time. There is a totality, an absolute, a oneness, and a whole, and nothing about it is ever fixed or the same, and it's continually coming into emergence at every moment, including every breath you take. And if you live between these realms, something happens to you. That's what I got.